to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman.
Hello, everybody. It is Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It's so nice to have you back. Thanks to everybody that's listened to our previous episodes, downloaded them, shared them with all your friends and family, left reviews. Every time you do that, you help more people see this content, and it's important. Well, in my eyes, it is.
So we think it is.
I have an amazing guest today on today's podcast, Doug Brignoli. Everybody, thank you, and welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast, Doug.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
I came across Doug's work actually through one of my followers who read one of your books. And they're like, you got to look at this guy's work. And I'm like, okay, this guy's legit. He's super knowledgeable. He knows what he's talking about. So let me introduce you, Doug. Doug's a veteran competitive bodybuilder, and he doesn't even know this, but I am a week out from competing in my first women's physique show next weekend.
I do know that.
Oh, okay.
I've been following you.
By the time people hear this, it will have come and gone. So you guys can
True. Yeah.
Go check Instagram and see how things went. But So he's a veteran competitive bodybuilder. He's a fitness and biomechanics expert. We're going to talk all about that. He's an author of a few books, a public speaker through his competitive career, you guys, which is over 40 years. He's not a spring chicken. He's won numerous bodybuilding titles, including the 1982 AAU Mr. America and 1986 AAU Mr. Universe. He's authored numerous magazine articles, co-authored a university sociology book called Million Dollar Muscle. His most recent book, The Physics of Resistance Exercise, has been endorsed by 10 PhD professors. These are people in the realm of exercise science, physics, neurobiology, biomedical engineering, and paleoanthropology, plus three orthopedic surgeons. He's conducted seminars throughout the US. He was just recently in my town here in Omaha, as well as abroad, including Japan, Mexico, Chile, Brazil, and Norway. Doug, it's so wonderful to have you and your wealth of expertise here.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm just a gynecologist, but I do have a degree in exercise science and nutrition, which is a little bit different than a lot of my colleagues. And so I can't wait to dive into some of this. So tell us a little bit about your background, bodybuilding, how you got into, like, you know, even wanting to be the expert in biomechanics and all these things.
I'm 62 years old now, and I started training at the age of 14. I started competing in bodybuilding at the age of 16. And, you know, when I was a kid, when I was growing up, I was the one taking the doorknobs apart, taking apart the clocks. How do these things work? I was always mechanically inclined. So it's no surprise that when I was 14 years old and we started doing this, I started saying, well, this is mechanics. It's pulleys, moving limbs, moving levers. And separate from my curiosity about mechanics, I've always had the good fortune of just really knowing what I'm feeling and having the logic to say, does that make sense? Like the right row, I said, but there's no way my wrists should bend sideways. Where does this thing end? Where's it supposed to end? It's not like a curl or a tricep where you know where it ends. An upright row, it's like here. You know, I would do parallel bar dips, according to the book, for pecs and triceps, and I'm feeling it in the front deltoid. These are important things. When you can identify what you're feeling and then logically saying, is that right? Is that correct? Is that good? Is that safe? That's where my curiosity started. So I started studying physics. I started doing cadaver dissections and studying anatomy. And then one thing led me to another. I would research this, and then I'd find this, and then I'd find that. And I realized that, you know, weightlifting is just basically classical mechanics. And when you think about it from that perspective, you realize that we've been guided by opinion, but there's no room for opinion. It's quantifiable. You could literally do the math. Mm-hmm. And once you understand, like, what comprises a productive exercise, that it's early phase loaded, for example. Early phase loaded means that more resistance is being put on the muscle during the early phase when it's more elongated, right? And less resistance is being put on it later. That's a better resistance curve than the opposite, than having it be too light in the beginning. You realize there is such a thing as better than and worse than straight across the board. Which means that when someone says, well, you know, there's 20 or 30 different chest exercises you could do. You say, well, they can't all be equally good. They're all a little different, right? So they're all mechanically different, right? So if you can identify what is mechanically best, and then you say, well, that's different than what's best. So therefore it's close to, but not as, so it's second best, it's third best, it's fourth, farther and farther away from that which we have now identified as ideal. And all of a sudden you start getting into this whole psychological issue of like, wow, how do I deal with, how do I wrap my head around the fact that we've been told a lot of things as if it's absolute gospel. And now we realize it just literally makes no sense at all, which of course gives me a lot of pushback.
Yeah, there's a lot of experts out there. Like, they've been in the gym and so they know exactly what they're talking about. And social media has really kind of blown that up, right? Like where people are getting their information. And I think one of the biggest barriers that people have that I encounter is they have never done resistance training before and they don't know where to start. What's your advice for those types of people?
Well, that's a good question. Let me just say that, and I like the word resistance exercise because it's bare bones. In other words, it is descriptive. Weight training, strength training is very ambiguous, right? Resistance exercise says, I'm going to do an exercise and I'm going to challenge that muscle or those muscles with resistance. And then you say, well, wait a minute, then if that's true, then a muscle that's being challenged with resistance doesn't know whether it's working by itself or whether it's working at the same time other muscles are working, which means that it doesn't care. It can't benefit. If I'm a quadricep, I don't benefit by the fact that my gluteus, the gluteus of this person, is also working at the same time. So the only thing that matters to the quadricep is whether or not it's getting what it needs optimally. What happens during a compound movement often is that there's compromises because there's two and three and four different muscles working at the same time. None of those participating muscles are getting worked as well as they could be worked if they were working individually. Maybe they don't have the ideal range of motion. Maybe they're not early phase loaded. Maybe the alignment is off. Maybe the resistance isn't appropriate. You know, a lot of times we see these, either a photo or an illustration, and we see the muscle, the target muscles highlighted in red. Now that is very misleading.
This because is just a quadriceps exercise.
because it suggests that the muscle is either on or off. Doesn't say whether it's getting full range of motion or not. Doesn't say whether it's early phase loaded or not. Doesn't even say whether or not it's being optimally challenged. So, you know, if you're working, let's say, parallel bar dips, and you see a drawing of a person doing in the down position, the up position, parallel bar dips, and you see front deltoids are highlighted in red, pecs are highlighted in red, triceps are highlighted in red, you go, all right, well, all three of those muscles have a different strength capacity. Mm-hmm. You're telling me that coincidentally, the mechanics of that exercise is optimally challenging each of those three different muscles, even though they have a different strength capacity. It's logically impossible for one of those muscles to be under challenged, another one to be over challenged. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening, right? So my book, I break it all down to the simplest thing. And I say, you know, each muscle has an ideal direction of anatomical motion, defined by where that origin and the insertion is, right? So for the pecs, for example, most of the origins are on the sternum, a little bit on the ribs, a little bit on the clavicle, but most of them are right here. The insertion is on the upper part of the arm, right? So if you're going to elongate that muscle, you're going to move it away from the midline. And then to shorten that muscle, you're going to move it toward the midline, right? That's going to maximally elongate, maximally shorten. That is considered an ideal anatomical motion for the chest. So why would this, which is parallel bar dips, be considered close to ideal? It's far from ideal, right? So you can't look at a figure that shows the pecs entirely lit in red and say, oh, says right there, it's a good chest exercise. No, the reality is the pectoral muscles participate, but not well. Not nearly as well as they would on a flat dumbbell press. Mm-hmm. Right? Because they're not following the ideal direction of anatomical motion. There's also an ideal direction of resistance, which is usually on the same plane as the anatomical motion and in a way that creates, you know, early phase load. So all of these things, there's actually 16 factors that you could use like a checklist, and you could look at every single exercise and say, does it qualify here? Does it qualify there? Does it qualify? And then you realize that there's a lot of exercises that we have treated as if they're, you know, the Holy Grail, and yet they miss five or six of those 16 factors.
What are some of those exercises that people think are the Holy Grail that are
let's start off really with barbell. Let's start off with barbell squat, and then I'll tell you the overhead press. But you know, we've been told barbell squats are the king, foundational. Okay, so as I said, we're made up of levers, made up of limbs. So the lower leg is a limb, it's a lever being operated by the quadricep. The femur, the upper leg bone, is a limb being operated by the gluteus. And the torso is a limb, a lever, that's being operated by the erector spinae of the back and also by the glutes. So when a person is standing in a squat and you look at them from the side, you see that all three of those limbs are vertical. Vertical is parallel to the direction of resistance, gravity, so it's neutral. Right, you can go up to someone who's got 400 pounds on their back, you can tap their quadricep and it's relaxed. You can tap their glute and it's relaxed. Mm-hmm. Because the limbs that are being operated by those muscles are in the neutral position. It's not until they break the neutral position that they start getting activated. And the percentage of load that that muscle gets is directly related to how far toward horizontal that limb gets. Right. It's no different than a pendulum on a clock. Right. So when you look,
so you got to get low. Right.
Well, yes. But well, let's say you're in the descended position of a squat and you're looking at this person from the side and you can see that their lower leg has tipped forward 30 degrees. Mm-hmm. It has not tipped forward 45, 65, 90. In other words, it's far from fully active. It hasn't even gotten halfway to fully active, which means the quadricep is only getting about 30% of the load that would otherwise be available if that lower leg could get totally horizontal. So what do? You feel you can handle more weight because you don't understand the load is being diminished by this inefficient lower leg angle. You put more weight on your spine, compresses your spine, increases the cost of the exercise. Mm-hmm. But you're only doing it to compensate for the inefficiency of that lower leg lever. So then you say, well, yeah, but can you see his or her upper leg lever has gotten horizontal in the descended position? Isn't that fully active? You go, yeah, it's fully active. But the second thing that magnifies resistance is the length of that lever. The longer the lever, the more the magnification. The shorter the lever, the less the magnification. The lower leg, because it's attached to the upper leg and you can't put the load on that upper leg bone without that lower leg and the foot, and it's doubling under, which means it's reducing the length of that femur. It's reducing what's called the moment arm, which is a physics term. So if you were to draw a straight line up from the heel and you take that from the femur to the hip and you go, so the lever that's being operated by the glute is only half as long as it would be if I could attach that resistance to the end of that femur as you would on a multi-hip machine. So you're getting half the load, you're getting a good angle, but half the lever length. So what do? Put more weight on the spine. Now, if you watch most people when they do a barbell squat, their torso tilts forward farther than their lower legs do.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty typical,
on that,
right?
Low back. Yeah.
That means that that lever is more active than the lower leg lever is active. And yet you're not trying, the exercise isn't meant to be a lower back exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is the torso more active angle-wise, it's also longer than the lower leg. So when you're doing squats, you're actually getting more load on the lower back than you are on the quadricep. Okay, so these are the mechanical things, but there's one more thing that makes the squat a really impractical exercise for quadricep development. And that is this thing called reciprocal inhibition. It's a neurological thing. Our bodies are designed so that you cannot activate two opposing muscles at the same time. Mm. So when you're doing curls, you're not aware of it, of course, because you could care less. Your triceps are relaxed, fully relaxed, shut off by the central nervous system to not interfere with the activation of the bicep. That's just how we're designed. So when you activate the glutes, when you're doing squats, you're deactivating the hip flexors. That's opposite hip extension, right? One of the four hip flexor muscles is the rectus femoris, which is part of your quadricep. So 1/4 of your quadricep is literally being disconnected, deactivated, when you're trying to do an exercise that's for the quadricep.
Is there any way that you can neurologically overcome that? Or is it completely
The only thing you can impossible? Do is not engage the glutes. Mm-hmm. So here's what's interesting. This is a perfect example of how dogmatic the industry has become. Is you will have a PhD in exercise physiology recognize that we did an EMG study, we put an electrode on that rectus femoris, and sure enough, it's not activated during squats. It's not activated during leg presses. So therefore, we recommend that you supplement your leg workout with leg extensions or sissy squats. Supplement? Why not just do the better exercise? Why would you waste time on an exercise that only works 3 of the 4 muscles when you can work that one that works all 4 of the muscles as well? In other words, the 3 that are working on the leg extension don't work less well than they worked on the squat. They're still working optimally. This is a perfect example of how a compound exercise is less productive and more costly than an isolation exercise.
Right.
Now, when you do the overhead press, we could spend forever on each of these exercises. You know, there's a simple rule in physics, and it's called the line of force. Whatever muscle is directly opposite the direction of resistance will be the most loaded. The way I explain it in my book is, imagine a clock. The first thing I'll do is, if you throw a rope over a tree branch, and you take both ends and you put a bucket on the end of these two pieces of rope, you put a weight in there and it's pulling down on that tree branch. And then you went up to the tree branch and you put a scale underneath the rope in different places, you would discover that the rope is pressing down hardest at the 12 o'clock position. Mm-hmm. 2 o'clock and 10 o'clock, not so much. 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, even less, because the line of force is right here. Whatever's opposite the 6 o'clock direction of pull will be the most loaded. Okay, so that means that if you want maximum benefit from a given resistance, you want to make sure the target muscle is directly opposite the resistance. Okay, so when you're doing a side raise, that's exactly what's happening. The side deltoid is directly opposite the downward pull. But watch what happens when you rotate your arm for an overhead press. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
The side deltoid moved to the 2 o'clock, 2:30 position. So there's just no way your side deltoid can be as loaded on an overhead press as it could be on a side raise. Mm-hmm. You saw the front deltoid rise up into more of the 12 o'clock position. And you might say, but I want front deltoid activation. And I would say, yeah, that's fine, except for the fact that there's some injurious aspects to the overhead press that you don't have to encounter on that other better front deltoid exercise over there. And that is, number one, in order to get your arm into the position for an overhead press, you have to externally rotate this humerus to a degree that is already borderline injurious. In fact, you can actually scout. You can go to the gym and look around, and when you're seeing people doing an overhead presses, you'll oftentimes see them doing this. In other words, they can't even get their arm vertical.
Yeah, they're going forward.
They have limited most people have limited mobility. That means you have to actually strain your shoulder joint, even without putting any weight on it, just to get in position. And then once your forearms angle slightly forward, this becomes a lever that wants to continue rotating forward. You have to reverse arm wrestle it to keep it from happening by activating the infraspinatus, which is your external shoulder rotator. But you're doing that with a weight that is way excessive for the infraspinatus because it's appropriate for the deltoid. So you're straining. That's why people have, one of the many reasons why people have shoulder pain when they do overhead presses, because they're straining their infraspinatus. Then when they push their arm up, they squeeze this tendon that comes from this muscle on top here that's called the supraspinatus, comes out from underneath the shoulder blade. It's called the acromion process. It comes out and it wraps around the humeral head, and its job is to keep that humerus in the socket. That's part of its job. The other part of it is to do the first 10% of the range of motion. So when you raise your arm up higher than parallel to the ground, you squeeze that tendon. It gets caught between the bone, the humerus, and the acromion process. And if you do that over and over again, it could be, you could create this thing called impingement syndrome, which is an inflammation of that tendon, plus the little gel pack that's in there called the bursa, the subacromial bursa. So you say, okay, well, I've got these mechanical problems, excessive external rotation of the humerus, impingement at the top, in order to get a compromised benefit to the side delta, because it's not in the line of force, and to get a front delta benefit that I could better get just by lying on my back and doing this. In other words, it's just not one of the better exercises. Does it work? Does it build muscle? Sure. But everything's a matter of cost benefit, right? So you're saying it's the cost on that is super high and the benefit on that is less high than you think it is. But the problem is you get a guy like Arnold who will stand on stage, or metaphorically speaking, anyone who's been doing it for a long time, and they look good. And one of the exercises they do is overhead presses. And you say, well, see, it worked.
Yeah.
Well, you don't exactly know what worked. You don't know exactly what worked.
Yeah.
The question isn't, can you get big or can you get well-developed by doing everything? Yes, obviously you can. The question is, can you get big, can you get well-developed by doing only the best exercises that are safest and most productive and most energy efficient? And the answer is yes, but you have to really open up your mind to let go of some of those exercises. Look, I'm 62. I weigh 204 pounds. You know, I'm not getting a compromised workout. I'm getting as good a muscle building benefit from my workouts now as I did when I was 20 and 30, when I was using a lot of these exercises and didn't know any better. And that's what everybody should be striving for. How do I get the most with the least? If you're buying a house, you don't want to pay more for the house.
Yeah.
You want to pay for less for the house.
Well, and for somebody like me, like, time's money. Like, I need to get in, train, get the stimulus, and get out. So what would be the most efficient way to go in and do that? If we can't use compound, you know, exercises.
Well, here's the thing is, when someone says, I'm doing a compound exercise because I'm able to work 2 and 3 muscles at one time, and that saves time, it's very efficient, I would say, hold on a second. If you think that the 3 muscles that are working during a compound exercise are getting all the benefit that they would get from 3 separate isolation exercises, then yes, it's a savings of time. But that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And most people know it. How do they know it? Because they also do a second quadricep exercise and a second gluteus exercise. You don't have to do that. You can just do 1 quad exercise, 1 glute exercise, 1 hamstring exercise, the best one, the one that rates 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, and then skip the one that rates a 7 or an 8 or a 4. Just skip it. That's your time savings.
Okay, so tell us what the 10 out of 10 is for these muscle groups.
Well, for, look, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell them to you cliff note version, right? But, you know, there's a reason for all of these.
Yeah. Let's talk about legs. So quads.
Okay. Well, the best exercise is an exercise that would give you full range of motion, meaning maximum bend all the way to the top, with a resistance level that allows you to get 15 to 20 reps, maximum burn. And that would be one of the various types of sissy squats. I do what's called a pendulum sissy squat. I have a weighted vest, a 40-pound weighted vest. I hold on to, like, you know, a bar, the bar that I use for the glute machine. I'm on a wedge, right? And I'm pulling back on this thing. So like I'm water skiing, right? And then I swing and let my knees go full bend. And then basically I'm kicking back like this. I'm doing kind of a leg extension version. Mm-hmm. Your quads will scream and you won't be able to walk for 2 days. And yet people go, you mean I don't have to squat 300 pounds?
Right.
That's exactly right. You don't have to squat 300 pounds. Just get out of that mindset that the exercise value is determined by how much weight you moved. The exercise value is determined by how much load the muscle got and what it felt, what it experienced. Multi-hip machine is by far the best glute exercise. By far. First of all, you get full range of motion. You don't get that on glute bridges. In fact, you don't even, you might get a full range of motion if you're doing deep squats. But when you get to the top, there's no more resistance. And when you're doing a multi-hip machine, you still have resistance at the extension part. You're using one leg at a time. So you're avoiding this thing called bilateral deficit, which is a slight weakening of both muscles when they're both activated at the same time. You have nothing on your spine. I mean, it's so far ahead of every other glute exercise that it's unfortunate that a lot of gyms don't have that machine.
Yeah, describe to people what machine this is.
A multi-hip machine is you stand on this a platform that's usually adjustable for height. And it's adjustable for height so that when you stand there, if let's say I'm going to work my right glute, the pivot of the machine has to be right alongside my hip pivot. Yeah. That way the machine and my femur travel the same arc. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you adjust the height so that it's right there. You take this lever arm that's got a roller on the end. You throw your leg over that roller, and now you've got resistance being applied at the very end of your femur. So you're getting the full length magnification of your femur. You're getting a full range of motion. It's about 110 degrees. You can bring your leg all the way up to your rib cage, and then all the way down. That's 110 degrees, far more than most glute exercises. You get resistance through the entire range of motion. Mm-hmm. You're only using one leg at a time. When I do it, I do 225 pounds with one leg. That's 450 if I was using two legs, but I don't have to spend the energy of 450 pounds. I just do one at a time.
Yeah.
And that's a hell of a lot of glute loading, far more than you'd get with a 400 pound squat.
Much safer, less
safer, nothing on your spine. One leg at a time, continuous tension, more range of motion. But people, when they go to the gym, they're in exhibition mode. They like to be observed. They want to be applauded. They want to impress people. You're not going to impress people when you're doing a multi-hip machine. You're going to impress people when you're over there squatting 300 or 400 pounds. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being the deciding factor.
Okay. So let's say you've got this 10 out of 10 workout. Is this something you can do day after day after day, or do you need variety? I mean, I hear people say, you know, your muscles will adapt. You've got to confuse them, do something.
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
Before I answer that, let me just tell you that the workout I use, the workout I recommend for everybody, anyone who wants to build muscle, this is the shit. Some people have heard of this thing that I casually call the Brig 20. It's actually like 22 exercises, 22 muscle groups. I have a three-way split. I do a third the body on Monday, a third on Tuesday, a third on Wednesday. I repeat Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I take off on Sunday. First day has six muscle groups, six exercises. Second, another six exercises, six muscle groups. And then the third one, there's eight muscle groups. And that's it. I do one exercise, same one, over and over again, because in most cases, there's certainly one. There might be a second that's as good or close to as good. But there's never a third. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, when you narrow it down, you say, this is the best one. Now, let's just say that you're going to compare this and this issue of variety to a suntan. You go out in the sun, your body has adapted. You've been going out there for the last 3 months. You haven't gotten any darker. You're going to switch it up. You're going to try infrared light, neon light, incandescent light, fluorescent light. Doesn't matter that it's different. Doesn't matter that it's new, right? What is best is best. Same thing with oxygen. You got tired of breathing oxygen. What are you going to do? Breathe helium? Best is best, right? When you switch from the best, you get an inferior result. If you switch from a skull crusher, let's say for triceps, it's early phase loaded and good. And you switch to a tricep kickback that's end phase loaded. You got no resistance at the beginning where you most need it and most would benefit from it, right? You might get sore, but soreness isn't a predictor, right? A muscle needs early phase loading. You're going to switch from an exercise that rates a 10 to one that rates a 3, right? And you're going to expect a better outcome?
Mm-hmm.
No. You might get sore, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the muscle is going to grow. So, you know, what I do is I do four sets for every one of those exercises. That's all you do. High, high, high intensity to failure. And this has a lot to do with the ideal frequency, which is no less frequently than twice a week. If you split your muscles into, you know, five different workouts and you don't get to work a muscle again until the sixth day or the seventh day, you've ruined optimal frequency. And you can't compensate for it with more intensity, more volume, more anything. You can't. I've tried it. It's dramatic, right? So you need to do just enough sets to get you to recover for another workout 3 days later. And then if you get burnt out, then you just take 3 days off, freshen everything up, resume, and everything's new again.
How important is it to go to failure? You said do high intensity to failure.
Good question. They did a study, and the study suggested that you can get equal amount of muscle growth with six reps and 80% one rep max weight and 30 reps, 40% one rep max weight. Okay, so the range is 40% to 80% one rep max. If you use lighter than that, 20% one rep, then you fall off the wagon. Now you get nothing, right? So you need to use a weight that is at least challenging for 30 reps, okay? What they discovered was that if you do a low weight, high rep set, you grow because you go to failure. And high fiber recruitment happens because the muscle is so exhausted. It says, hey, come on, everybody, join in, right? Mm-hmm. Conversely, if you're getting high fiber recruitment from the six rep set, because you're using a weight that's 80% of your one rep max, the very first rep recruits high fibers. The very second rep, you don't have to take that one to failure. This one you do. However, I think that it depends on your body type. I did not grow well on six rep sets. I tried for years. And when I switched back to 30, 20, 15, 10, boom. Mm-hmm. I'm an ectomorph. I think ectomorphs grow better on high fatigue. And maybe an endomorph grows well. A big bone person will grow well on the heavyweight, low rep set, but I do not. So for me, I am absolutely convinced if you want to grow muscle and you're not an endomorph, you have to go to proximity to failure, close to failure. So what I usually tell people is if you're going to do four sets, which is what I do and recommend, the first set, I use 85% of my maximum effort. I might have two or three reps left in reserve by the time I quit, but the muscle is burning like crazy. It's screaming. On the second set, I go to 90%. Then on the next one, 95%. Then on the next one, 100%. Effort. So on the last one, you should have either no reps left in reserve, meaning you know your next attempt at a rep will fail, or you actually failed on that last rep. The previous one, you might have one rep in reserve. Next one, you might have two reps in reserve. First one, you might have three reps in reserve. But if you're getting high, high, high burn, you're in the growth zone. You're in what I call the red zone.
How much time should you take between these sets that you're taking pretty
much? You're asking all the right questions. So they did a study that showed that resting longer is better. If you rest, let's say, 1 minute between sets, and you compare the growth of that to resting 3 or 4 minutes between sets, they found that you grow significantly more if you rest longer. Now, there's an interesting dichotomy here. You say, well, wait a minute. So if super, super high fatigue to failure sets make my muscles grow, then why wouldn't resting shorter and increasing that fatigue make me grow? And it has to do with how well that set is executed. You execute a set better if you're fresher. So if you rest, let's say 3 minutes before your next set, and you start relatively fresh and you go out of the way to failure, that set is going to be very, very, very productive. So what I do is I usually alternate between unrelated muscle groups. I might do lats and calves. Biceps and triceps is fine because they're opposite. Mm-hmm. Front deltoids, rear deltoids are opposite, right? So that's fine. So if you alternate between two exercises, you can pace yourself about right. By the time it takes you to get back to that first exercise again, it's relatively recovered. You might still need to rest another minute or two, and there's nothing wrong with that. the idea that your workout will be better or more productive because you rest less is wrong.
Okay. Okay. Makes sense.
When it comes to growth.
Okay. Talk to me about static versus dynamic.
You know, we all know that full range of motion is more productive than partial range of motion. And partial range of motion is more range of motion than static, which is isometric, no movement at all, right? Mm-hmm. They've done a number of studies that have shown that you get very little growth from an isometric exercise. You get strengthening with an isometric exercise, but only in that one place in that range of motion. Mm. So if you held a barbell like this, that bicep is going to get strong in that position, but not so strong in other positions, right? So, you know, some people sort of like take that and go, oh, so if I'm a boxer and I want torso stiffness so that when I get hit, you know, so are you suggesting that if you do a full range of motion for your abs, that that middle part won't be strong? Mm. No, if you do full range of motion, everything gets strong, including that spot, right? So now, other research has shown that partial range of motion isn't quite so bad as long as it's at least 70% of the range of motion and it includes the very beginning. So if you're going to do an abbreviated range of motion, let's say triceps, and you're only doing the last part, that's bad. If you're doing this, that's not so bad. I bottom out all the way, and then I usually take it to about 70, 80%. I don't lock out. You don't need to lock out.
Yeah.
But that first part, which is called the stretch position loading, critically important.
This reminds me of, have you seen the X3 system, Dr. Jukie? Yeah. So it's like full extent. It reminds me of zone 1, 2, 3, like how he's described it.
I'll tell you what the problem with elastic bands is that elastic bands are weaker, give you less resistance when they're shorter, and harder when they're more elongated, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the opposite of your muscles. Your muscles are stronger at the beginning and weaker at the end. So anything you do with an elastic band, as your muscles getting weaker, it's giving you more resistance. Mm-hmm. As your muscles getting stronger, it's giving you less. Now, I always tell people, look, elastic bands are convenient. They're portable. They're better than nothing, mm-hmm. but they're not as good. They're less good. Unequivocally, less good than resistance exercise with regular weights and cables. Absolutely. Plus, you know, you are obviously limited in the direction of the resistance you can apply with an elastic band. You know, that's why I don't like things like, you know, a reformer on Pilates, is because it's very limited in the direction of resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, now if that trade-off is worth it to you, if you say, well, look, I just can't afford to have more space or more equipment and I'm willing to take the compromise, okay, fine. But don't expect the best results with something that doesn't have the optimum, the direction of resistance.
One thing I see a lot in the gym is very distracted people, you know, going through the motions. How important is like that neurologic engagement? Can you like tell people, you know, like, should you really think about squeezing the bicep? Like, how important is it for your brain to engage in the exercise?
You know, I used to work out at Equinox and then they closed for COVID. And then my training partner and I put a garage gym together. Equinox reopened. We never went back. Mm-hmm. Now my training partner has injured himself. And so he's on crutches. He can't work out. I work out by myself. Love it. Why? No distraction. Sometimes I even turn the music off. My body, your body, is talking to you in the middle of every set. It's telling you all kinds of things. It's telling you how many reps it has left in reserve. It's telling you whether it feels any twisting in the joint. It's telling you whether or not you should increase or decrease on weight on the next set. These are all things that need to be considered, thought about, and decided upon during the workout. It's not, I wouldn't say that your muscle is going to grow because you wished it to grow, but your execution of that exercise is going to be much, much better if you're paying attention.
Okay. Talk to me about core strength balance. A lot of people, you know, like my parents are aging, you know, functional fitness is like a big thing. What's the best way to optimize that?
You actually talked about three different categories.
I'm just
there.
Being strong as shit.
Yeah. You talked about four things. So let me just talk about the core. The core is four muscles. It's forward flexion, backward flexion, lateral flexion, rotation.
Yeah.
Okay. So when someone says I'm doing the plank for core, I say, well, you're doing one of the four and you're doing it isometrically. So number one, you're working 1/4 of the core if you're doing an actual crunch with dynamic movement, but you still have the back part, the lateral part, and the rotational part. So no, core, we should be clear about this. It's not some, you know, mystical thing or some spiritual thing, right? Like strong to the core. It's like, no, it is four anatomical motions.
Right.
You need to do all four in order to make sure that your spine is protected. That's that. Balance is something else entirely, right? When you have one person standing on one leg, that's a bad idea. Number one, the exercise you're doing, let's say you're doing curls, now is going to be compromised by your instability. Your biceps are going to get a better workout if you're standing on 2 feet. That's number one. Number two is, when you talk about your parents losing their balance, that balance loss is not going to be fixed because they learn how to stand on one leg on a BOSU ball. That's micro adjustment, right? Macro adjustment is what your parents need. What does that mean? Did you see that guy during the early part of, I don't know, a couple of years ago, they were having a riot in New York. He was an older gentleman, like 70 years old. He was at a riot and the police pushed him and he fell back and he hit the back of his head and he got a concussion.
Yeah.
I have that saved because I screenshotted it. And you can see he's standing, he's pushed, he's falling, his feet are planted. All he had to do was step back with one of his feet. You have to readjust your center of gravity when you get pushed one way or the other. You're not going to learn that by standing on one leg. What happens is older people forget. They lose athleticism. They forget how to sidestep, how to backstep. The best thing you can do for your parents is to have them shuffle side to side, throw a basketball, shuffle back, throw the basketball, shuffle back, throw it, side movement, and then run back, run forward, run back, run forward, run back, run forward. Now, if they get bumped, they're going to reposition that foot and they're going to catch their balance.
Yeah.
You know, microscopic adjustment of the foot, you know, how to stand in the shower while you're washing the other foot. That's completely impractical.
You mean shaving your legs, Doug? Like where you put one foot up on?
I discovered when I shaved my legs in the shower. No, no.
Well,
honestly, because
you're in bodybuilding, I'll give you a pass. You've had to shave.
Well, the truth is, I don't use a razor. I use electric clippers.
Yes. Okay.
If I was a girl, I'd want smoother legs. A guy, not so much.
It takes balance. Micro balance.
Yeah. Anyway, for your parents or for anybody who's, and by the way, balance is equilibrium, which is an inner ear thing. That's
right.
It's almost misnamed. But if you want to get your parents or any senior to lessen the likelihood that they're going to fall, get them jogging side to side and back and forth. That's the best thing they can do because that's what's going to save them if they get bumped anywhere.
Yeah, it's incredible when you look at the data on just like as a physician, we use like the get up and go test, like just the ability to stand up out of a chair without using assistance on the sides can literally predict your 10-year mortality.
I mean, athleticism.
Like, yeah. Really basic things.
Yeah, and it's having familiarity with those movements.
Mm-hmm.
And don't do that at the same time you're lifting weights because you're going to get a compromised benefit on both.
Yeah. So sarcopenia is a huge deal, right? Like we're not just over fat in America, we're under muscled. So I'm a huge proponent for, especially women, they just are far more intimidated by resistance training, you know? And so I've really tried to be an advocate and a model kind of in that arena, but talk to us about, go ahead.
I was going to say, cause this touches on the last one, which is what makes a body stronger. And the problem that most people have is that they confuse what it is to make your body stronger with demonstrating that your body is stronger. So if you squat 200 pounds, you say, I'm making my body stronger. and I'm demonstrating the strength of my body. Mm-hmm. And I would say, okay, but what if we didn't do a squat at all? And what if we challenge that quadricep maximally, and we quadricep that, and we challenge that gluteus maximally, and the erector spinae maximally over there? Now you're working on the sum of the, you know, the parts of the total, and you maximize the strength of each of those. And then you took, let's say, the person who's only doing squats, and you test their muscles individually. You would find that that person's quadriceps are no more strong than this person's was who did it isolated. That mm-hmm. person's glutes are no stronger than this person's glutes. That person's erector spine is no, but this person over here didn't care about demonstrating it with one single exercise. Mm-hmm. You can demonstrate it with 3, 5, 20 different exercises, the strength of each individual muscle, and then you have a strong body. But we can
think, do you think it's caught up like Olympic weightlifting? Like that's just the persona like that people have around big, strong people, is that it's squat, bench, and deadlift? I mean, where does it come from?
There's, look, I have a section in my book where I talk about where this started. It started in the late 1700s, early 1800s with strength exhibitions. This was circus acts, right? There would be a guy who picks up a baby elephant.
Strongman.
Strongman, you know, demonstration. Now, at the time, not only did people not care about much other than impressing people and earning a living by impressing people, but they didn't understand biomechanics. And there's one magazine in my book, I show a lot of different magazines that had as a banner on the bottom, it said, "Weakness a crime, don't be a criminal." Suggesting that it's immoral to not be strong, and worse, immoral to not demonstrate strength. Mm. In fact, they used to say that isolation exercises were vanity oriented. Why? In other words, if you challenge a muscle in an isolation exercise, it has to get stronger. Why wouldn't it? You think an isolation exercise is just a cosmetic thing? If you make a muscle move its limb and you do it with a significant amount of weight, with a significant amount of intensity, it has to accommodate that demand by getting stronger. It will get stronger. It's not just cosmetic, right? So the idea that I need to do a compound movement that demonstrates the participation of 5 muscles at one time, or else none of those muscles will get stronger, that's completely logical, mm-hmm. right? You can strengthen all your muscles individually as much or more by doing isolation exercises as you can by doing a compound exercise. And by the way, there's a huge psychological component to this too, right? In other words, the people you were just describing who are a little intimidated by it, I don't actually blame them. I understand the idea that you want me to stand underneath a metal bar and have this thing press on my, and I need to balance myself and I need to coordinate what is basically an athletic event, mm-hmm. right? Whereas if you tell someone, here, just either use this leg extension machine or hold on to these rails and just start with a little, you know, mini sissy squat, then go a little deeper. They go a little deeper, you know, that's much less intimidating and just as, if not more, productive. You know, we have to get around the psychological barrier for, mm-hmm. and it happens to not compromise the physical outcome.
Yeah. Okay. The other component of muscle health comes with nutrition. So I'm fascinated to hear how you eat.
You know, I'll tell you a quick story. I had back surgery about 5 years ago. I had a little herniated disc. They needed to snip that, no problem. And before any surgery, they want you to do a pre-op. Just make sure you're healthy, blood tests, EKG, all that. And my friend, who was the physician, happens to be a cardiologist. He was going to be doing the pre-op. He said, hey, as long as you're here, why don't we do this thing called a calcium score, which tells us how much plaque you have in your arteries. I saw here on your health history that your father had heart disease. You know, you're 57 years old, you know, let's take a look. Great. Turns out I had a lot of plaque in my arteries. Why? I work out 6 days a week. I've been eating low fat, American Heart Association food pyramid for decades. How could this be? So I called my friend, Jeff Feliciano, who's a biochemist. And I said, what's going on? He goes, well, if you've been following the American Heart Association's guidelines, that's a recipe for a heart attack.
Yep.
I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, he goes, it tells you to eat the most of anything, potatoes, rice, pasta, bread, flour. You know, those are all high glycemic insulin producing foods. Then it tells you to eat the smallest possible amount of fat. If you were to eat more fat, you would slow down the absorption of all the starch, but you're not. So now you're accelerating the absorption. He says 80% of the cholesterol that's in your body, you made. Mm-hmm. You didn't eat it. He goes, what's your cholesterol right now? I said, well, now, surprisingly, it's high, right? Up until a year or two ago, it was always under 200. Now it's 290. He goes, okay, do me a favor. He says, for the next 3 or 4 months, I want you to eliminate all your starches. I want you to get all your carbs from vegetables and fruits. I want you to drastically increase your fat intake, mostly from avocado and olive oil, but also whole eggs, beef, butter, ghee, coconut oil, nuts, whatever you want, as long as it isn't a trans fat or a polyunsaturated fat, like a safflower or a corn or something like that. Because you should be getting at least as much fat calories as protein and carbohydrate calories in your diet, and then eat moderate protein. So like 30, 30, 30, a third, a third, a third. In four months, my cholesterol went down to 138. So imagine 290 eating low fat, 138 eating high fat. Moral of the story is Mediterranean diet.
Mm-hmm.
Mediterranean diet.
Yep. Yeah.
Don't worry about the fats. I'm very lean. If I'm going to get on stage in September, I'm going to probably cut down my fat calories to reduce the calories. But, you know, one of the worst things people can do is eat high starch foods, especially if they have a history of heart disease or diabetes, because they'll be more likely to produce insulin spikes and deal with the consequences of that.
Okay, so I'm fascinated just to hear your opinion. This wasn't part of what I was originally going to ask, but so in the bodybuilding world, it's very traditional to eat low fat and higher carb. And last year, my husband did his first bodybuilding show. He's coached by Robert Sykes, Keto Savage, who competed as a regular normal bodybuilder for many years and then transitioned to ketogenic and just came out with his own first book just very recently, a couple months ago. And he's coaching me and in my show next week. And so I've been completely ketogenic this entire time, less than 10 grams of carbs. And then obviously we just moderate energy calories, fat. But I have the ability to draw labs on my husband and on myself. And, you know, I'd love an N-of-1 experiment. And it was amazing. Maintained testosterone levels, maintained everything. I mean, like not a lot of the bad things that happen sometimes with bodybuilders. Do you think the bodybuilding world has it wrong when it comes to the dietary approach, or is it just multiple ways to skin a cat?
You know, I don't think that a person has to be ketogenic to be healthy or to get lean. I think there's some health benefits to producing ketones. There's no doubt. But I think if you were to eat, let's say, squashes and sweet potatoes, which are low glycemic, minimize your fruit intake, maybe just blueberries and things like that.
Yeah.
You're not going to spike your insulin very much.
Yeah.
You're obviously not going to use your protein calories for fuel unless you absolutely positively have to. And then you'd lose 70% of its calorie content anyway in the transition. And so, you know, I think what you need to do is find something between keto and what could be considered a very low glycemic, moderately low carbohydrate diet that is not quite keto, but allows you to cut your fat calories a little bit more and then maybe makes you feel better, maybe makes you get equally.
That's how I normally live. A little squash, a little sweet potato, a few berries.
Yeah.
And no, I'm totally with you.
Yeah. I think keto is a little bit difficult to manage.
I still produce ketones at 50, really? 75. Yeah. I've been doing it. So I'm just so fat adapted. I can do 50, 75 carbs and still produce ketones. It's crazy.
You know, I don't know. I much prefer to eat a higher fat diet and a lower carb diet. I never like
good
eating things dry.
Yeah.
You know, I'll eat, let's say, you know, 5 or 6 egg whites with 2 whole eggs. I'll throw a half of a sweet potato in there, avocado, tomato juice. Yum.
Carbs are only good with fat on them, but fat can be consumed without carbs and taste damn good.
I told a friend today, years ago, I told people to eat bread without the butter. Now I'll tell them eat the butter without the bread. Yeah. And by the way, one of my favorite snacks is brie with almonds or cashews.
Yeah. Love some brie. Love some brie. Okay. All right. So to end my podcast, I do something called the semen analysis. You brought this up earlier, your 16 biomechanical factors. So I just want to hit those for everybody. And then I want you to tell people where to find your book and how to get more information about all this awesome stuff, because this is like, we've just barely skimmed the surface. Yeah. Of these topics. Okay. So number one, ideal directions of anatomical motion.
Right. So I'll give you a good example. If you were to stand in front of a mirror and put your arms out to your side and draw an imaginary line from one hand to the other hand, goes right across your shoulders, right across your clavicle. And you say, how much of my pecs is below that line and how much is above that line? Obviously, all of it is below that line, right? All muscles pull toward their origin. If I give you a rope and I tie the other end to a box and I say, pull on the rope, that box is going to move toward you. It can't move anywhere else. If you're a muscle origin and that box is a limb and you contract, there's no way that limb won't come toward you. And yet, what do? When we do incline presses, we move to an area where there's no pectoral fibers.
Yeah.
If you go in a straight line, you're already going to the highest part of your pecs. If you go down, you're still going to pectoral. As soon as you do this, there's nothing above. Now, if your arms were attached to your torso right in the middle, between the highest and the lowest part of your pecs, there'd be something to go up toward, but they're not. They're already at the very top. Mm-hmm. We evolved as quadrupeds. We progressively pushed more downward, but we never had to push upward.
Yeah.
Right. So that's an example of an improper anatomical motion. Right. So that's, you know, we have to make sure that we're moving in a way that not only makes the most sense for the activation of that muscle, but also is most safe for that joint.
Absolutely. Okay, so number two, utilizing optimal range of motion. You're saying full range of motion, optimal lengthening, optimal shortening, right?
That's kind of an obvious one.
Yeah. Okay, number three, avoiding neurological conflict of interest. This is that idea of when the bicep is going, the tricep is completely relaxed.
Yeah, reciprocal inhibition is one. There's also, bilateral deficit is another one, which is the weakening of a muscle when they're both working at the same time, so that you want to avoid those things. So you're getting full activation.
So better to work it unilaterally. Is that what you're saying?
If you can. Now it's easy to do this. It's not so easy to do this.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So sometimes it makes more sense to do that bilaterally because it creates too much instability otherwise.
Okay. Number four, ensuring sufficient length of the active muscle.
Okay. So yeah, what that means is, let's just say that you're going to, I always tell people, if you want to experiment with this, just stand up, hold your hands on a chair, take your femur and move it back, and then do a leg curl, and you will feel your hamstring cramp. What you've done is you've moved, and this only applies to muscles that cross two joints, like the hamstrings or the bicep, right? So when you move the insertion too close to the origin, it overshortens it and creates active insufficiency, right? So that's why a seated leg curl is far better than a lying leg curl. Because when you bend the hip joint, you move the insertion farther away from the origin, you get a better lengthening of the hamstring, and now you have more power and less compromise.
Yeah, okay. Number five, avoiding excessive stretch of the antagonist muscle.
Okay, so this would be an example. Let's just say you're doing a leg extension. You're sitting on a leg extension machine and you're going to lean forward and you're going to extend your legs. And as you do that, you'll find that your hamstrings are stretching. In fact, if you lean far enough, you'll find that you can't actually straighten your knees. All right, that's passive insufficiency. That means the passive muscle, the one that's on the other side, is too stretched. What's the solution? Lean back. Move the seat back farther on the leg extension machine. Let there be less of a hip angle. Open that hip angle up. Now you can do your leg extension without any interference from the hamstring.
Okay, awesome. Number six, favoring unilateral loading. This is what we talked about. If you can do it unilaterally.
Yeah. Yeah. To avoid bilateral deficit.
Okay.
Oh, the load. This is the loading. This is the loading. I'm sorry. What this means is that you're better off with two dumbbells than a barbell.
Got it.
Loading each limb separately, even if you're doing them simultaneously, is better than using a single instrument.
Okay.
Always.
So dumbbells over barbells.
Dumbbells and cables over barbells.
Dumbbells and cables over barbells. I love it. Okay. 7, favoring unilateral muscle activation when possible.
Yeah, that's avoiding bilateral deficit.
Okay. 8, avoiding limitation from weaker peripherally recruited muscles. So this is trying to isolate the muscle group and not doing compound movements.
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. Let's just say you're doing a deadlift and you're doing a deadlift for the, let's just call it the posterior chain muscles. But the muscle that's doing the most work is going to be the muscle that is extending the hip, which is the glute. Biggest, most powerful muscle in your whole body. But guess what? You can't load it unless you involve the erector spinae, which is a less strong muscle. So that's why when you start getting heavier and heavier on your deadlift, you notice that the spine starts to roll forward. Why? Because in order to totally load the glutes, you have to overload the erector spinae. If you were to not overload the erector spinae, you underload the glutes. So what's the solution? Multi-hip machine. Avoid loading the erector spinae to get to the stronger muscle.
Yeah. Which comes to the next one, avoiding unnatural joint torque and unnecessary spinal loading.
Squat is unnecessary spinal loading. Deadlift is unnecessary spinal loading. Doing an overhead press is unnatural torquing of the shoulder joint. Upright rows, another unnatural movement for the shoulder joint. Incline press, another unnatural movement for the shoulder joint.
Okay. 10, favoring an optimal moment arm by avoiding secondary limb reduction of the target muscle's primary lever.
Okay. So we talked about this earlier. If you want to load the glute, the best way to do that is to use the full femur length. Mm-hmm. By involving the lower leg, you use that secondary lever, not on purpose, but what it does is it shortens the moment arm of the femur, right? Let's just say you're doing a press like this, right? If you go like this and open your arms up, you're lengthening the moment arm. But if you go like this, you're shortening the moment arm. You're letting this bone shorten the upper arm bone. And so you're lessening the magnification.
Okay. 11, favoring an optimal moment arm of the target muscle limb by ensuring a perpendicular direction of resistance.
Okay. So let's just say that you're going to compare parallel bar dips with flat bench skull crushers as a tricep exercise. We talked earlier about how any limb is most active when it's horizontal and least active when it's vertical, right? So when you're doing parallel bar dips, or by the way, bench dips, your forearm, which is the operating lever of your tricep, is mostly vertical. It's mostly neutral. So if you look at someone from the side and you say, well, I can see that their forearm is tipped back about 10 degrees from the neutral position. So let's just do some basic math. 10 degrees is about 11% of the way to horizontal. So remember that 11%. We say, okay, you weigh 180 pounds. Two arms is 90 pounds each. Times the length of the forearm, which is a 12-to-1 ratio, times that 11% equals about 119, 120 pounds of load per tricep. Okay. You might think that's a lot, but if you took a pair of 20-pound dumbbells and you got on a flat bench and you went like this, 20 pounds times 12 times 100%, not 11%, is 240 pounds of load per tricep rather than 119 or 120 pounds. And what's the difference in energy cost? 40 total pounds versus a body weight of 180, because the forearm gets horizontal, perpendicular to gravity. Parallel bar dips, it does not. That's the difference between making sure your limb, the limb that's operating your target muscle, gets perpendicular with, and I say perpendicular with resistance, because when you're talking about free weight, it's always horizontal. But if you're dealing with cables, it's whatever the direction of the cable is.
Right. Okay, 12, avoiding exercises that include a base or apex at the mid-range of the motion.
Tricep kickback. You know, when you're doing this, you know, you've got the base is the lowest point of the arc. The apex is the highest part of the arc, right? It's going to be neutral. So if you put your arm on a tabletop like this, you have zero resistance on the bicep here, and you haven't even finished the range of motion. So same on this. right? So you don't want there to be a neutral spot in the middle of the range of motion for your target muscle. You want to avoid that.
Okay. Number 13, ensuring opposite position loading by utilizing a direction of resistance that's opposite the target muscle origin.
All right. So for example, let's just say you're going to do a low pulley row and you're doing it for the lats, right? Well, the direction of resistance is not opposite the muscle fibers. That would be something from the outside of the spine coming toward the spine, right? Mm-hmm. If you're doing this, you're loading the rear deltoids.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So another example is if you're doing, let's say you're doing this for a front deltoid, right? Let me see if you can show it better this way. If you're doing this for front deltoid, but you realize the side deltoid is still opposite resistance, you want to rotate that arm around so the front deltoid is opposite resistance. Whatever's opposite resistance will be the most loaded, whether you planned it that way or not.
Yeah. Okay. Number 14, favoring exercises that provide early phase loading.
Okay, that's like comparing skull crushers to tricep kickback. You want the early part of that range of motion to be more challenged by the resistance than having the latter part be more challenged.
Yeah. Okay. Number 15, ensuring stability during resistance exercise. I think we've hit on that a couple of times. Uh-huh. Yeah. And number 16, favoring exercises that allow appropriate resistance levels.
Okay. So for example, let's just say you walked into the gym and you were going to do a flat dumbbell press. And you know that a flat dumbbell press is a good exercise. But the only weight that's on the rack is one pair of 60-pound dumbbells. Now, under that set of circumstances, this is not a good exercise.
Right.
Which is the same reason why you wouldn't do a pull-up if you can only do 3 reps.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or parallel bar dips if you can only, not that it's a good exercise, but if you can't use the right weight with that exercise, even though that's a good exercise, today, under these circumstances, that's not a good exercise. So too little weight and too much weight are both a waste of time and possibly dangerous. So you want to make sure you can use the right weight or it's not worth doing. Now, this is a very good checklist.
Yeah.
Right. All of these things are better than or worse than.
It seems, I mean, to me, these things absolutely make sense, but I have a background in, I mean, obviously I know anatomy, every muscle group you're naming, but what about for just your average person that doesn't have the knowledge, but that wants to maximize efficiency, strength, hypertrophy? Should everybody have a coach? Do you think people can do this on their own? I mean,
well, you know, I'm not expecting everyone to say, okay, here's the 16 factors, happy hunting. No, what I'm saying is these are the exercises we recommend. It's called the Brig 20. There's 20 exercises and each one has maybe 2 or 3 alternatives. So it ends up being like 40 something exercises.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know why, go look at the 16 factors. This is the reasoning for it. This is the backup for it. It's not a matter of opinion. It's a quantifiable, measurable thing.
And people will find this in the book, correct?
It's in the book, yeah.
Tell people about your book, where to find your book, how to work with you.
The book is called The Physics of Resistance Exercise. It's available as an ebook or a printed book. If you want the ebook, you can get it from the publisher, which is Healthy Learning. If you want the printed version, you can get it on Amazon or from me, my website, DougBrignoli.com. And if you want to work with me, I can do consultation for you. You know, just email me at dbfitness@aol.com and it's $150 and I can send you materials. I can send you photos and videos. We can chat about them. You can tell me if you've got some injuries and things you've had to worry about, we can work around those things. But yeah, I mean, I think coaching is a good thing. I mean, I don't like giving anyone more than what they need. You know, I'm not a commercially oriented person. I like to think of myself as being sort of like professorial. I want you to learn and I want you to understand why this is good and that's not so good. But I'm not going to be the kind of person that says, you need me for the rest of your life. I'm going to keep changing exercises for you forever. And this idea that different exercises, that not everybody's the same, everyone needs different exercises, nonsense.
Amazing.
Everybody's elbow does the same thing. Everyone's bicep does the same thing. What's good for your bicep is good for my bicep. The only difference is intensity, which is weight, sets, reps, frequency, all of that.
I love it. Well, Doug, this has been enlightening. Thank you for your time and for your wealth of knowledge. And You guys go check out Doug. He's on social media. You can go to his website, find his book. It is called, say the title one more time.
The Physics of Resistance Exercise.
Yes. The Physics of Resistance Exercise. All right, you guys. Well, thanks for listening to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Make sure you download, share, leave your reviews. That's super important to us. And we will catch you on the next episode.
Bye, everyone. Thanks so much. Bye, doctor.